God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. This is Brother Hutchings inviting the listeners to these stations to another Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Church Ministries. And here now is Brother Jerry to introduce our broadcast.
Thank you, Brother Hutchings. Again today, Brother Hutchings and I will be talking about his updated book, As It Is in the Days of Noah, which is his life story. This is the book that he wrote originally in 1998, but has just recently updated, bringing us up to date with what's happened to him and the ministry since 1998. So even if you have the original book, you'll want to get a copy of the new one, and we'll tell you how to do that a little bit later in the program. Brother Hutchings, as we start today, let's go back a little bit to some of the things maybe we talked a bit about yesterday. Now, you had mentioned that you moved around a great deal.
Yes. First memory I have where we live was on a lady whom we called Old Soapy. Actually, she wasn't that old, but we called everybody, I think over 30 years old, 40 years old and old, and we lived in 15 places during the time I was born until I went in the Army and finished high school. And every place was old somebody's place. Usually they were old places. Mm-hmm. I remember a couple of years ago, my three sisters and I went back to Hugo, got together, and we got in a car, and we went to every place where we had lived from the time that we could remember when we were born, places we lived during the Depression, later on when we went to high school, and they were all gone. There was not one of them left.
Really?
They were old places, you know, and they were all torn down, and not one place. Many of the houses, there were trees growing up where the house had been. But as I write in my book, Hugo, nearby Hugo, the county seat, is still there. Still about 5,000 people there, population. That's about what it was when I was born in 1922. Hugo has survived because of one reason or another, mainly age-dependent children, I guess.
You know,
and the grace of God, of course.
Right. Well, you know, that is a bit unusual because in most cases, cities either grow or just completely go away. But to maintain, that's kind of unusual.
Yes, it is. The place we live down in Boggy Bottom, it's still a small community there. You know, I remember the school we went to when we lived at Boggy Bottom. I rode a horse to school. Weren't in school buses then, of course. Not very many people had cars. There was no TVs. We didn't have a radio. We did have a wind-up Victrola, and I think we were middle class because we had a wind-up Victrola that we played records on. And a lot of people would come by to hear some of the country singers like Jimmy Rogers then and others. But the school there at Boggy Bottom was a one-room schoolhouse. One teacher taught all 8th grades. No air conditioning, no electricity, no electric light, no central heating. There was a pot-bellied stove out in the middle, and this one teacher taught all 8th grades.
You know, Brother Hutchings, you mentioned the 8th grade. I remember my grandparents, for example, talked about having an 8th grade education. A lot of people mention that from that era. Well, I got an email I have not verified that this is actually true, but I think it is. It says this is the 8th grade final exam from 1895 in Salina, Kansas. It was taken from the original document on file at the Smoky Valley Genealogical Society and Library in Salina, and reprinted in the Salina Journal. I'm not going to go through this whole exam. It took, I think, about an hour and a half for a person to take it, but this is an 8th grade final exam. In grammar, it says, give 9 rules for the use of capital letters. Name the parts of speech and define those that have no modifications. Define verse, stanza, and paragraph. What are the principal parts of a verb? Give principal parts of lie, lay, and run. Those are just a few. Now, let's go to arithmetic. Name and define the fundamental rules of arithmetic. here's a good one for you. A wagon box is 2 feet deep, 10 feet long, and 3 feet wide. How many bushels of wheat will it hold? How about history? Give the epochs into which U.S. history is divided. Relate the causes and results of the Revolutionary War. Show the territorial growth of the United States. And there are other things. Here's some from geography. What is climate? Upon what does climate depend? Of what use are rivers? Of what use is the ocean? Describe the mountains of North America. Name and locate principal trade centers in the U.S. This exam, well, actually, I said it took about an hour and a half. Actually, it took 5 hours to complete, and we only touched on a few of the things in there. But it really does give the old saying, or she or he only had an eighth grade education, a whole new meaning, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. You know, some people say, well, you surely couldn't learn anything. No electricity, no computers, or no central heating. Hot in the summer, cold in the winter. One teacher teaching eighth grades, how in the world could you ever learn anything? By today's standard, that would seem to be back in the Ice Age days or back in the days of the dinosaurs. But we managed, and I think students then were more eager to learn and more anxious to learn, and you didn't have to encourage them to learn. And, of course, at night we did our homework with a coal oil lamp. Even you don't remember the coal oil lamp.
No. No, I'm not quite that age. As a matter of fact, this exam was in 1895, so that was 4 year time even. But you did go further than the eighth grade. You went through high school.
Yes. I remember going to high school, first year in high school. Now, we did have, by that time, a bus that went out, and we were able to ride the bus to high school. Of course, we had to get up early first and milk the cows and do the chores about 4:30 in the morning and get up cold mornings and take the buckets out and milk the cow, get hit in the ear with a tail full of frozen cockleburrs. That'll wake you up. But it was a great life. I think it develops character. Let me put it that way. I remember the first year in high school. I particularly remember our coach, Oz Dungis. He also taught a civics class. But I remember Oz Dungis. He was a Republican, and he let everybody know that he was a Republican. Now, a Republican in Little Dixie was something, especially as a teacher. And he taught civics. And he was convinced that Franklin Roosevelt was going to turn the United States into a communist nation just like Russia. And he did not like Franklin Roosevelt at all. And he really let his classmates know why he did not like Roosevelt. And I remember at that time there was some kind of a commodities program. People were hungry, and it was probably a good thing, and they had distributors to distribute cheese and beans and cornmeal and flour and lard to those who were in desperate need. And I had an Uncle Henry who was a FDR distributor. He lived up on Cloudy Mountain. And one day I had an uncle who had an old Essex. Not many people still had cars back even when I was a freshman in high school. But Uncle Fred took the family up to visit Uncle Henry up on Cloudy Mountain. And we got there, and being a distributor and being convinced that FDR was United States Messiah, he had a huge picture of Franklin Roosevelt out on his front porch, about a 10 by 10 picture, cardboard picture. And Uncle Henry took the family around the back to the storeroom to show him his store of commodities. Knowing Uncle Henry, he probably would say, well, here's a pound of beans for you, and here's a pound of beans for me. Or here's a pound of cheese for you, and here's a pound of cheese for me. But in any event, he was showing the family his commodities in the storeroom in the back and left me out on the front with Franklin Delano's picture, whom I was convinced was Satan's helper, who was going to turn the United States into a communist nation. So there happened to be some Crayolas there on the desk just inside the door. And I picked up a black Crayola and went out and drew Mr. FDR a pair of glasses, a mustache, a goatee, and then drew him a couple of horns up on his forehead, and then wrote on it, FDR, the harebrained idiot. And here come Uncle Henry leading the family around again to the front porch, and he saw the picture that had been desecrated by me. And he began to rant and rave and jumped up and got his shotgun and said, somebody has done this. I want to know where they're at. Where did they go? He began to look under the floor and up and down the road in the bar ditches. He was going to kill them. He had his shotgun. To someone who would dare do that to his idol, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he charged back at me and said, did you see anybody do that? I said, no, I didn't see anybody do that, but I had done it myself. And so I think the family kind of knew that maybe I had done it. When my mother gathered the family up and we got back in Uncle Fred's car and took off back home, and I was sure relieved. But that was one of the incidents I write about in the book.
Yeah, you were a mischievous little feller, weren't you?
Well, I was dedicated to what I believed at that time.
Well, obviously the coach had a great influence on you.
Yes, he did. Oz Dungis did. And later on, when I worked for the ministry, he came up to see Dr. E.F. Weber. I was surprised to come to Oklahoma City. He was running for state senator, I believe it was. But this being a Democratic state still at that time, he didn't get elected. But, you know, we did finish high school, and immediately after high school, though, you know, war clouds were gathering in Europe. Hitler had conquered almost all of Europe, I guess all of Europe, threatening the invasion of England, and then Pearl Harbor happened on December 7th, 1941. Then the draft, and I was of draft age, and so I was drafted into the Army, inducted at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, was shipped to Camp Roberts, California for basic 13 weeks, and my unit was field artillery. I was trained in field artillery, fire direction, and survey. Shipped down to Fort Ord for ranger training for 6 weeks. At that time, some of the soldiers in the South Pacific, particularly, were having trouble adjusting to the kind of life in the South Pacific, fighting. Some of them were having trouble mentally, standing up under the rigors of training they had to go through, standing up under combat. So we were given 6 weeks of ranger training and then shipped overseas. And overseas, I did not end up in a field artillery unit, though. I ended up in an aircraft, 90 millimeter. Ever who was taking care of the Army then or signing soldiers, I probably didn't know much difference between field artillery and an aircraft artillery, but there's considerable difference. And I was assigned to the unit, and I was given the job of figuring firing data for the field artillery unit, 90 millimeter, which was entirely different. Mm-hmm. And I had been there in the unit for just a few days, though, and here come a van in with a parabola on top of it. It was radar. And very few people, even in the Army at that time, had seen such a radar unit. So they told me, said, well, there it is. I asked, what is it? And they said, radar unit. And they pitched me a manual to teach me, or I was supposed to learn myself, how to operate a radar unit. But finally, I think after a few days, some fellow did come around and trained me and a couple of other fellows how to operate a radar unit. It was an excellent unit. Figured all the firing data for the guns, had cables going to the guns, the 90 millimeters, We had 16 90-millimeter guns, and the radar unit figured all the firing data, told the guns the elevation, the azimuth, the direction, even set the fuses for when the fuses were to go off when they got near the airplane. Oh, it was a marvelous unit. And there was a little unit on the back on wheels. And we asked what that was, and they said, well, that's a computer. That's the first time I'd heard the word computer. And the computer figured all that out.
Now, what year was this?
Beginning of 1943.
Okay.
Maybe end of 1942, mm-hmm. I think it was. Mm-hmm. And it was by that time that about a year or later before I got overseas after December 7th, maybe a little longer. And I spent about three and a half years in the Army in the South Pacific.
And Brother Hutchings, where exactly were you located? Was it an island?
Well, we first went to New Caledonia. It took about 10 days on a ship to get from San Francisco to New Caledonia. There was no escort. It was a huge ship. I think they crowded about 10,000 soldiers on that ship. I think beans was all we had to eat because they couldn't put that much food, different things for soldiers. Mm-hmm. I think we ate beans about three times a day. And then when we got to New Caledonia, they shipped us up into the hills to staging area, and here come an old colonel out, and he said, take these boys out on a 25-mile hike and see what they've got. Well, there was Air Force units and Navy units with us also, but we had just gone through Ranger training, mm-hmm. and we were hardened and wasn't in trouble for us. But the Air Force unit, for example, they started off singing the Army Air Corps, nothing can stop the Army Air Corps, but I'll tell you, a 25-mile hike in about 110-degree weather, mm-hmm. well, high humidity would stop the Army Air Corps because not any of them even got out to 12.5 miles. They had to send trucks out to pick them up. But our group, we actually double time about the last 5 miles back into camp.
Ranger training was very rigorous, and still is.
Oh, it is. And we went on after that, after we got to our anti-aircraft unit, got proper training on the radar. We went up into New Guinea, and then went on up to the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. All this information, folks, is in the new book, the updated edition, As It Is in the Days of Noah. And you can get a copy of that book by calling, writing, or visiting our internet website. One copy for your gift of $18, two copies for a gift of $30 or more. And I believe, Brother Hutchings, if folks would like to have that book autographed, you'd even do that, right?
Have pen, will autograph.
Okay. As a matter of fact, that's in the mail out that you received this last month. Have pen, will autograph, and he'll do that if you'll just let him know that. But anyway, you can get one copy for a gift of $18, and the phone number to call is 1-800-652-1144. If you'd like to write for it, the mailing address is Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008, and the web address is swrc.com. Brother Hutchings, during the war, one of the main characters was General MacArthur. Did you have any dealings with him?
Not directly, of course, but we did go in the second day at Lingayen Gulf, and, you know, he did too. You know, saw him waiting. Mm. You know, we were there on the beach. We had set up there on the beach, and General MacArthur came in. We thought a lot of General Douglas MacArthur, the Army did, because he considered his men, and he would not risk lives without reason. He bypassed strongholds and just froze them out, cut them off, rather than risk soldiers in order to take a position that could be bypassed and cut off. Everyone in the Army that I knew of thought highly of General MacArthur. I know he wasn't thought too highly in some of the political bastions here in the United States. But I think Iwo Jima, if he had been in control of Iwo Jima, we would never have taken Iwo Jima. Now, when we got to the Philippines, there was a huge kamikaze attack on our convoy just off Bataan Peninsula. I think the Japs sent every plane they had almost as kamikazes to try to sink as many ships as they could. And really something to be in a kamikaze attack. You talk about graphics. Wow. And when we got in on the island on Luzon, there really was no Japanese planes to shoot at. Now, Japan had recalled, I think, all their air force because they were expecting an invasion of Japan, and they were saving all their planes for kamikazes. And there was no plane to shoot at. So they put us in as a field artillery unit with the 1st Cavalry Armored Division. And for the rest of the war, I figured field artillery again. Firing data for our anti-aircraft battalion. And I really enjoyed it because that was something that I liked to do. And very, very good. We were not in a radar unit anymore. I was out where I wanted to be, out firing field artillery for field artillery pieces. Mm-hmm. And it was really an enjoyable time for me about the last 6 months of the war.
And, of course, the war ended with the atomic bomb in Japan. Brought the war really to a close and so forth. Where were you when that happened?
I was on Luzon.
Still there?
Yes, it was getting up in the fall of 45, and we were wondering why we were not getting ready to invade Japan. I know I thought, well, if they don't hurry up, they're going to have to wait till 46 because no one would be stupid enough to invade Japan in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And so we were waiting for orders to get our unit ready to board ships to go to Japan, but nothing was happening, no orders. And then one day we were told that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima. And then a couple of days later on Nagasaki. And then the war was over. It was anticlimactic. Here we'd been over there fighting for three and a half years, away from our family, no food half the times, living in horrible conditions, and here we dropped two bombs and the war is over. Mm-hmm. See, it seemed so needless all the time we'd spent over there. So you would think that everyone would have been happy that the war was over, but the way it ended, it made our service over there kind of seem so depreciated, although I know it wasn't, but still, it ended so sudden.
And, of course, the end of the war changed Brother Hutching's life. We'll get into that a little bit on tomorrow's program. But in the meantime, you'll want to get a copy of As It Is in the Days of Noah. One copy for a gift of $18, two for a gift of $30. You get it by calling 1-800-652-1144. Write to Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008, or visit the website, swrc.com. Stay tuned for a Bible and the News report on most of these stations. Join us tomorrow for another Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Church Ministry. From Oklahoma City, today's Bible in the News report is presented by Dr. Larry Spargimino.
While most Americans have been focused on the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina, we have to ask this question. Is this America's price tag for disowning 9,000 Jewish settlers? In the days preceding the Gaza withdrawal, the following figures and statistics had been released by the Israel Project, and I quote it. 100% of the Gaza Strip will be evacuated and handed over to the Palestinians. 21 Israeli settlements will be uprooted in the Gaza Strip. 48 graves in the Gush Katif Cemetery, including 6 graves of area residents murdered by terrorists, will be uprooted. 2,842 homes will be destroyed and the rubble removed at Israel's expense. 38 synagogues will be blown up in the Gaza Strip. 287 public buildings will be left for the Palestinians. 5,000 school-aged children will need to find new schools. 42 daycare centers will be closed in the Gaza Strip. 36 kindergartens will be closed in the Gaza Strip. 7 elementary schools will be closed in the Gaza Strip. 3 high schools will be closed in the Gaza Strip. 320 mobile homes ordered by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will serve as temporary housing for settlers, with approximately 300 additional mobile homes to be ordered in the future. 45,000 Israeli soldiers and policemen are expected to participate in the Gaza withdrawal. $1.7 billion is the approximate cost of the Israeli government for the withdrawal initiative. 800 cows, comprising the second largest dairy farm in Israel, will be moved out of Gush Katif. $120 million in flowers and produce exported annually from Gush Katif will be lost. 10,000 people employed in agriculture and related industries in Gush Katif, including 5,000 Palestinians, will need new employment. 60% of Israel's cherry tomato exports come from the Gaza Strip. Israel's withdrawal from Gaza will extinguish this economic resource. Almost 1,000 acres of greenhouses will be abandoned in Gaza. 70% of Israel's organic produce is currently produced in Gaza. This is another economic resource that will be lost. Zephaniah 2, verse 4 says this, "For Gaza shall be forsaken, and Ashkelon a desolation. They shall drive out Ashdod at the noonday, and Ekron shall be rooted up." The U.S. State Department is one of the prime instigators of the Land for Peace arrangement. Where does this put America?
And that's today's Bible in the News report. These radio reports are available in printed form in a Bible in the News magazine, which is published 12 times a year. To receive a sample copy of the magazine, call or write Southwest Radio Church Ministries. The phone number to call is 1-800-652-1144. Write to Post Office Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008. If, after receiving the magazine, you'd like to subscribe, the annual gift amount is only $35. If you find stories such as the one you heard today interesting, consider subscribing. Call or write today for your sample copy of the Bible in the News magazine, a publication of Southwest Radio Church Ministries. Be sure to join us for the next Watchman on the Wall program and another Bible in the News report on this station.